Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. In the days after Kate Bowler's surgery for stage 4 cancer, she began letters to her young son and reckoned with the idea that he might read them after she was gone. She writes in her new memoir, "I used to think that grief was about looking backward, old men saddled with regrets or young ones pondering should-haves. I see now that it's about eyes squinting through tears into an unbearable future." Kate Bowler is an assistant professor at Duke Divinity School. She's the author of Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved. And she joins us today from Durham, North Carolina. Kate, welcome. It's really a pleasure to have you on the show.
Aw, so glad to be with you.
Have you retrieved any of those letters that you wrote, and have you read them again?
Oh, man. Well, like, I have a whole collection. And that's been part of the weirdness, I think, of, like, continuing to live, I guess, is trying to maintain a sense that, like, I'm always, like, I think with any kid, you just want to build a story for them. And the story that I wrote in those letters and I keep writing is, like, I love you, I love you, I discover you every day. But also, like, please know who I am in the middle of this.
So you are writing new letters now, even though you've come through the surgery. I mean, you wrote some of these letters right after the surgery. And as you say, you're living on, but you continue to write for him.
Yeah, honestly, it got a little confusing, though, because at first all the letters were the same thing as my memory journals for him, like all the regular stuff that parents keep, I think. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, like, oh, no, I do not want to, like, ruin all of his children's books with, like, my super drippy, I love you so much. So I was like, okay, we need new categories. Like, one, loving letters from me for no matter what. And then two, like, what were you doing when you were 3 and how much did you love Lego? So I'm trying to, like, keep clean categories. But the truth is the whole thing is muddled with my love and grief.
It's hard to imagine creating a memory journal that wouldn't be infused with your experience, your fear and your pride and your determination and your optimism, right?
And I think it's weird because, like, a diagnosis like mine, like, divides your life in two. There's a before and then there's an after. And then in the after, you really lose the ability to speak in the future tense. You don't say, like, oh, when you're 10, or, you know, in 2 years, I plan on, you know, seeing the pyramids. Like, you stop saying it. You learn to hope for things, but you just stop speaking in that way. But at the same time, when you look at your kid, kids are all the future tense, you know, they're all like milestones and things you hope for them. So yeah, when I look at my son, I think that's, like, the hardest part of the two parts of my brain to reconcile. The one that's giving up on the habits of speaking of the future, and then the other part that just wants to say, like, oh, I know exactly how this is going to turn out, and you're probably going to be an astrophysicist.
Have you stopped talking about the future with your husband, too? Or, I mean, even in your own mind, or does this only apply to your son?
Well, I think I struggle. I think I struggle, like, with, I don't know, like, it took me forever just to start buying clothes again, which sounds weird, but, like, you really double down fast. And so every little thing feels like you're stretching time out and practicing being both present and future. So I don't know, lately good things are helping me do that. Like, honestly, I never thought I'd see this book published. And so seeing it out in the world, like, I wrote those first, like, that little dedication to my son, like, on the first minute of my chemotherapy treatment. Like, it wasn't even a book yet. I just had hope. And so it helps me practice thinking forward to just see beautiful things come to fruition.
I can't imagine not having your voice to, you know, to be part of this experience of reading your memoir. I'm so glad you're here to talk about it.
It's, you know, we're like in a weird spot with cancer treatment, right? So chemotherapy was this sort of obliterate and destroy model. And immunotherapy, it's just not clear what it is. Like, does my treatment put me in purgatory forever? So I'm just always on the edge of things. Is this actually like a cure? Is this just a, you know, a waiting pen? I don't know. But in the meantime, I'm only my age right now this one time. So I just can't afford to like let medical science decide how I should feel about it.
Yeah, the language, right, of medicine has had to change with some of the experiment. Are you still in the midst of your experimental treatment?
Well, I'm in the kind of managing illness phase where I get scans, like I had one last week, and that means that I'm feeling chipper about life because I get like 3 more months till my next scan. But it's this kind of ritual, it's like this litany where I begin in hope, and then the 3 months passes, and then I have to go in to see how my tumors are doing, and if they're great, then I take a deep breath and I start all over again.
You feel freed for 3 months. Month increments.
And like that sounds small, but like honestly, that's a whole season, right? Like it's a different way of thinking about time. Like that's spring, that's summer. Like I can do something with that. Before, when it was the crisis, like when I just thought, man, I'm this spaghetti bowl of cancer and I can't look ahead at all, that was exhausting. That was hard thinking in any way. But like I can think creatively about what I can do in a season.
Have you gotten better at taking your husband's advice, which I think is just so brilliant, which is don't skip to the end? Have you figured out how to do that?
No, I'm the worst. No, I really am the worst. Yeah. No, I learned nothing. It's so hard because like I wrote this book to try to like get down to the studs of my life. Like, what did I expect? Like, I was so surprised to be sick. There was no cancer in my family. And then I had to interrogate, like, wait, why am I so surprised? Like, why do I think I'm the exception to the rule that bad things happen? And so trying to learn those lessons, I kind of went on this sort of spiritual existential journey trying to like be honest with myself about my expectations. But at the same time, I have to get up every day, get treatment, like fight for the right kind of access. Like, so weirdly enough, I'm having to cultivate this passivity in one part of my brain, like, accept what's real, be present. And on the other side, like super Rambo mode, you're like busting into the hospital looking for treatment. So it's really hard to like not skip to the end because they're both those things are asking different things of me, you know?
I think this is something that Paul Kalanathi, the late Paul Kalanathi, explores in his memoir, When Breath Becomes Air. And of course, he was in the middle of the medical field, right? I mean, he was a neurosurgeon. He knew how the medical field presses on and how it behaves and responds, right, when you're in the middle of this. But he was so powerful in hanging on to that present, to that don't skip to the end part of it. I wonder if you've read the memoir.
Yeah, yes. And like, his wife is just so beautiful, Lucy. And I think one of the things I've learned from his writing and her life is that time is less like a calendar, like, you know what I mean? Something you map out as you look at it in a flat way. And it's more like a place you visit. Like it's something that can stretch out and encompass like moments, real experiences. And he was so good at letting the beauty of that take up more space in his life. And that's exactly what I want to do.
So if time is less like a calendar, but you have these 3 month, do you think of them as respites when you can then go back to the calendar and say, I'm going to live this. I'm going to retrieve what I had in the before. Or is that gone for good?
I don't know. Because there's certain parts of my old self I'm recovering, like, you know, being gossipy or bored or sarcastic. Like, what's weird is, like, you give up stuff. Like, you give up some of your bad habits really quickly when you're going into this kind of intense triage with your life.
Yeah.
And then you realize that you totally miss, like, not being hyper aware of time. Like, watching the new season of The Bachelor and, like, not being as hyper, you know, conscious of the repercussions of every decision. So part of it is that, like, I feel like I'm recovering a tiny bit of normal, but the rest of it feels like I am on a slow march to the edge of the cliff. And by the time I get there, something had better be built. And in the meantime, something else needs to happen, which is that I experienced something interesting with my son, and I was a decent wife and friend. And so that I'm trying to get better at. Like, that is also actually stuff I have to put in the calendar. Like, this weekend, we're going to go to the zoo, you mm-hmm. know? That's the stuff you have to plan. Otherwise, I think otherwise the fear will just take up too much space.
Right. You know, I was thinking as you were describing what you say are your bad habits, that those really are the things that make us human.
Totally.
I mean, otherwise, you sound incredibly saintly, Kate.
Yeah, no. Right? I'm not. I'm the worst. No, I'm like very, you know, sarcastic and probably evil. And I mean, I really like,
evil.
I think what's, yeah, totally evil.
No.
And I miss, because what's funny is, I think that's maybe what was like a little embarrassing for me to talk about is I don't think I'm so great. Like, but in the moment of the most crisis, I felt the most intense love, like love of God, love of other people. That felt like a weird moment of saintliness. But it didn't feel like, wow, I really earned this. I'm totally different now. It just felt like I figured something out, which is like when you're cracked open, all of a sudden the world is just more gorgeous. So that felt less like, wow, I really discovered something special about me, and more that I kind of now understand a little bit more of like the secret to the universe.
I'll tell you what I marvel at is just your way of describing this, the beautiful language that you reach for. And now I realize not just in the memoir, but just in everyday conversation.
Aww.
It's a real gift, Kate.
Well, the thing is, like, I'm kind of just beyond pride, I guess. Like,
what does that mean?
I don't have a lot of dignity left. Like, the medical world has seen most of my body. You know, I am like forever getting these terrible side effects. Like, I am so glad we're on the radio right now because I have these like horrible allergic reactions I'm dealing with right now. Like, just side effects of cancer, blah, blah, you know. And like, I'm a mess. And accepting that and not in a faux humble way means I just get to say, oh my word, I need people more than I thought. Also, I think I need a nap. Also, like, what is today about? It's clearly not about me being awesome.
That's right? A lot of work. What you just described, I need a nap, and what is today about? Oh my gosh, if I had to come to some conclusion every day about what today is about... Oh.
Well, I think I want a break from it too.
I don't think I've got the resilience that you have to come to that. And you're finding that resilience in the midst of this. Wow.
But that's other people, right? Like, when I feel sad and, you know, maybe a little hopeless and angry, then I see other people who are doing something beautiful with something terrible. And like someone said something really smart. I think it was Nadia Bowles Weber. She said, pain digs out of you a place that then joy can fill. Mm. I thought that was so true. Like, it's not, I don't, maybe I had a capacity before, but like the fact that things continue to perpetually suck really is like digging out a space, and then other stuff has to rush in. And lately it is how totally hilarious my deeply narcissistic 4-year-old is. I mean, like, or, you know, it's more simple things. Because I think before, and that's what I was trying to be honest about in the book, is I think before, it's not that I was, I was pretty ambitious and, like, always trying to get to the next thing. But, like, when I'd go on a trip, I'd always assume, like, oh, I'm going to go on a million more trips like this.
Yeah.
Like, it was almost boring in the present. Like, oh, I'm going to do this a million times. But I treated my life like it was a series of consumables. And it was my job then to like sort of like snack on it and stay happy.
Mm-hmm.
And like that's – I'm sort of horrified by that now. Like, why did I think it was – that life was about me perpetually consuming things for my own enjoyment? Like that sort of gave me pause.
You know, when I think about what Nadia said, that pain digs out this space and that joy rushes in. I mean, I think mm-hmm. that's also what you were saying. And if it's not joy, then fear fills that up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
right.
And
you're conscious to not let that happen.
Well, and I mean, the place where I'm the most fearful is, like, I'll just be honest, like the place where I'm the most fearful is the hospital. Like I walk in and I just feel like, oh, this is the place that's going to take me over. And I've got the hospital bracelet on and I can see all the other people with their bracelets on. And the only way I get through is I think like, well, those are my people. Like, we are the losing team, but like, they know something that I'm still learning, which is that like there's still life there somehow, but I just can't let myself be eclipsed by this thing I didn't choose.
Kate Bowler is with us. If you've just tuned in, we're talking about her memoir, Everything Happens for a Reason, and other lies I've loved. And I've been spreading the word about this memoir. You might have seen me tweeting about it. I've been telling friends about it. So it's a true pleasure to talk to Kate today. And as you're listening in, I hope the conversation's resonating with you in some ways. Perhaps what Kate said about that before and after in your life, right? Something cataclysmic changes. It's a diagnosis. It's a loss. Do you have that sense too? Did it change the way you perceive time and the world around you? Is there a before and after in your life? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. Kate, what you just said about the hospital reminds me that I wanted to talk to you about some of your experiences with, you know, the treatment and what I call the medical industrial complex. You have this wonderful and really meaningful incident where the intern has come in with the results of your surgery and your tests, and he comes to talk to you about the results, and he's going to talk to you about your longer term survival rate. Yeah. And do you remember what you say to him as he's talking to you about this?
Oh, man, it was 4 a.m. You feel insane because you're mostly on drugs and you're like hooked up to every needle and you feel just like paper, like everyone is durable and you're just paper. And this little intern comes in and I knew he was bottom of the barrel. And he comes to me and he says something like, all I could hear was like, blah, 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 30 to 50% chance of survival. And I knew already that survival to them just meant reaching 2 years. And all I could think of to say was, you'd better be holding my hand if you're going to say stuff like that. Because, like, all you think of is, like, am I real? Like, am I still real? Like, because you can't believe it's happening to you. And so, and you also can't believe that, like, the worst news of your life comes in a way that has no dignity to it. Mm. Like, you're the intern. Why is it you? So, yeah, you just want touch and you want to just feel like you're connected to something that holds you down.
It was also the most compassionate of responses. I mean, do you know you taught him something really important, I hope, in that moment?
Well, I've come to realize only later that doctors are humans and like a lot of them are completely amazing. But at first you just think like there's a wall between you. You're the fancy professional and you're here as part of your professional development. And I am just this object that is now open for examination. And it felt good to start seeing us as people in a moment again. Because I needed them. Like, I needed them so badly just to be people with me.
Right. Including that physician's assistant, right, who tells you sooner you get used to the idea of dying, the better.
Yeah, she was super charming. She was so charming.
What happened? Kate, I know you've done some thinking about this. What happens? Yeah. These people are not, well, they're not uncompassionate people.
No.
I know that. They're in this field. They must be caring. What happened?
Well, I think, I mean, for some people, and that was hard because, like, she was my age. And I know that people get compassion fatigue and a lot of burnout. I mean, there are people who break their own hearts doing this work. And I get that now. But at the time, what was so frustrating for me is, like, I felt like I was begging for them to see me as a person over and over again. Like, because I work right where the hospital is. So I would kind of come over in my blazer and I was trying to show them, like, hey, I'm a colleague. Like, hey, I'm doing work here. Everything about it was me trying to say, like, we're not so different, are we?
Right.
And I think part of it is that maybe they just have the high volume of people requires them to care less. And for some people, they just maybe don't have the kind of training to understand that even just behave, that empathy can also just be behavioral. It can just be like a tone of voice and the way you can make eye contact. And also just give me a minute. Like, most of the worst news I get, like, they just rush out the door. And I'm like just trying to understand the words that were just spoken. So that's been really hard. I mean, I'm really grateful now that I have more friends that are doctors who help me see the world from their eyes. But this whole thing was characterized like from the patient perspective, I guess.
Mike says, I got diagnosed with cancer when I was 43. I was told I had 5 days. When I had 5 days, all that mattered were the people in my life that I loved. I'm 60 now. I became altruistic. I wouldn't trade a second. Mm. And to Sarah in Minneapolis. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. So I am a breast cancer survivor of 7 years, and I got diagnosed at 35, so I was pretty young. And before that, I mean, I was an actor, and I traveled all around, and I was poor and starving, and I was a waitress, and really, the day after I was diagnosed, I woke up about 6 a.m. and I said, I might not be here a year from now. What do I want? What do I want out of life? And I answered it. I said, a family, vacation, a career I'm passionate about, and I'm on my way. And during the time when you don't know what's going to happen, when you're facing death, reality starts to shimmer. Like you just... You break open and you realize what's truly important. And it becomes beautiful in a way.
Wow. What a great way of describing it. Reality starts to shimmer. Wow. Like the feeling I had was like, I feel bright and clear. And like, what a gorgeous description of things that really count.
Is that something, Kate, you ever could have, you know, fully grasped without this experience? And this is not a show that says, you know, right. I don't want this to be that show. And I think we know, but I'm saying from the outside looking in, having not had an experience like this, I don't know if I fully grasp what you and Sarah really mean.
Well, and I think that's exactly right. Like, when I describe things that I found there in the darkness, you're right. I don't mean to say that like this was to teach me a lesson and the lesson is so valuable.
Right.
And the lesson means that the suffering was not like a tragedy. But yeah, like it, I don't know if I'm more myself than I would have been before, but I feel more human. Like I feel more connected because I get that we're all so fragile. And that is something that only coming to the end of myself taught me.
This is something I think you wrote in the Wall Street Journal. A tragedy is like a fault line. A life is split into a before and an after. And most of the time, the before was better. Few people will let you admit that out loud. Why?
Well, because they want to I think it's because it feels horrible to look at someone you love and say that their life is diminished.
Right.
That somehow, I mean, and I think they want you to rush to that part that says that with your enhanced perspective and that you gained something more than you lost. And sometimes, and this is what I wrote, is like, sometimes it's the people who love you most that are trying to get you to say that. And they are looking at you and they are counting everything up and they just want to say like, right, it still all adds up, right? You're still fully yourself and there can still be more. And I don't know how to say to them, like, but there are things I lost and I want them back, you know. That's always hard.
Call here from Michael in Savage. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thank you for this conversation. I just wanted to share that I'm shaking as I listen to you. October 2016, my husband was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer spread through both sides of his liver. I'll tell you the story ends happily, but when he got back from his colonoscopy, a very human doctor came back while my husband was still sedated, and I asked him about the colonoscopy, and it turned into, I asked him, he said it could be colitis, it could be cancer, and I said, what do you think? And he said, I think it's cancer that spread to the liver, And I pushed him, but part of the conversation said, you know, it could just be that you have to make him comfortable for the rest of his days now. And I went into this shock, and the nurse then kind of brought me the tissues and said, okay, he's coming to, you know, brave face, wipe your tears. And when the doctor came back to talk to him, I looked at the doctor like, if you repeat to him what you just told me, I will stand up and knock you over.
Take you down, right?
And he didn't. And I kept that secret till we got a second opinion at Mayo Clinic, where I found out they would try to fight the cancer. But that's powerful, and it changes the filter how you see the world. Yeah. It was a long year and chemotherapy, and didn't know if he'd qualify for surgery. He had two surgeries. So thank you for sharing. I did learn doctors are very human, but nobody can prepare you for that experience.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And you're like, it's so weird when you meet a doctor in what you think is something routine, like a colonoscopy, and then like they're some of the biggest actors in the drama of your life. Like they're characters now. And like some of the characters are amazing and some of them you want to punch in the face, but like they are there in the things that define you.
Kate Buller is with us. If you've just tuned in, we're talking about her memoir, Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved. Kate, to a call here from, I think, a friend of yours, to Jason in Collegeville. Jason, is that right?
That's right. Kate, are you there?
Hey there.
Hey, it's Jason Schlutie calling from Collegeville, Kate. Kate and I went to McAllister together, and we need to talk more, Kate. I shouldn't need to call NPR News for this, but we both went to McAllister together, and we were both religious studies majors together, and I remember her as a fellow classmate and a friend there, and it's just been remarkable to listen to you speak this morning, Kate. And of course, and it's been so interesting and just meaningful, and I'm learning so much listening to you talk about the before and the after of the experience that you're going through right now. And yet at the same time, Kate, just from my angle and from the outside, I can't help but note the continuity of just how beautiful you are. You know, how in the time that, you know, we had a McAllister together, when I watched you, you were just so full of love and insight. And I remember watching you thinking, this is somebody really special. And I treasure this person. And the fact that I'm continuing to listen to you and just watching your beauty unfold, you were such a cheap teacher then to all of your friends and your classmates. And just you're still so much of a teacher now, and you're reaching so many more people. I just want to say thank you, and that I love you, Kate.
Oh, buddy, love you too. Thanks. That's so sweet. It's just like, man, I'm getting so emotional right now because I think like what you wonder after something happens is like, am I still the same person? Like, do I still? Because the feeling you have, at least I had when I was in the hospital, is like you feel like you're in grayscale and everyone's in color. Right. And like you just feel really disposable. And so to still feel like the same person, I'm just really grateful for that affirmation.
You know, Kate, this is really natural, but I've noticed that, you know, when Jason says the wonderful things about your teaching, and when I've been saying this is such a meaningful memoir, that feels a little uncomfortable to you, I think.
Oh, totally.
And that is natural, but have you had to get used to this? You're making a difference.
Well, I think that just like it tips so far into gratitude for me because you do things not imagining that they will make a difference to anyone but yourself. Like I wrote it to try to be honest and mostly for my son, just to say like, here I was really ridiculous. I mean, I had some really stupid ideas, but I also figured a couple things out. Most of them I learned from love. And so it means a lot to me to hear other people say that they felt fragile too, or that tragedy undid their lives, but that there's still something there that we can all live into. And that's what gives me a lot of hope.
Arden called a little earlier. He says, my daughter passed away from cancer. I used to believe that everything happens for a reason. I now believe that's BS, something I never expected happened to me and my family.
Yeah.
I want our listeners to know there's a bit of a sarcastic tone to the title of the memoir, right? And yet it comes from your work.
Yeah. So I spent 10 years being like the expert in the history of the American prosperity gospel. So I went around trying to map out the history of how people believe that with the right kind of faith, that God will give them health and wealth and all around happiness. So I interviewed televangelists and preachers and people in the pews. And I said, what does it mean to ask God for more? And that was like the big, I think that was sort of like the intellectual quest is like, what would happen if you asked God for everything? What would hope look like? And that was the maybe the toughest part to reconcile intellectually is when my own life came apart is maybe I wasn't so different from them after all. Maybe I was sort of expecting that God would give me everything I hoped for.
I think there's a cruelty to the idea of the prosperity gospel. Do you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that
yeah,
make sense?
Yes.
I mean, it suggests that impoverished people somehow deserve, you know, whatever suffering they're going through because they're just not committed enough. I don't really know what to do with that.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's the best and the worst part of it. The best part for people in the pews is they say, look, I mean, and a lot of them are like struggling to get their lives together too. And they go to a church with a lot of jubilant worship and celebration and a pastor who seems to have it all together with a perfect family. And they see an example of someone who has hoped for everything and achieved it. And the sort of agency that gives people is, well, if it worked for me, it can work for you too. Mm-hmm. And that's given people a lot of traction in their lives. The cruelty, though, is that, yes, when you actually fall and cannot get it back together, when it's an illness or perpetual unemployment or something that means that you just can't look as faithful as everyone else, that really is both exhausting and shaming.
So as you were investigating this and writing about this idea of the prosperity gospel, were you coming to some conclusions about where it would meet your own faith and belief?
I don't know. Like, historians are wonderfully distant creatures. Uh-huh. We sort of come in, keep a neutral expression, have a clipboard, and then like moonwalk out. And so I tried really hard, especially because I was writing the first history of something that everyone naturally hates. I wanted to write a kind of inherently lightly compassionate account so that people would first understand it's basically like why millions of Americans would do it in the first place. I wanted to render it intelligible. But when I came into it, I was as sort of dismissive and sarcastic as I think everyone else is. And then it was, and I have my opinions, you know, about which televangelists I love or do not. But it was the people in the pews that got me. Like, it was the people with hope in their hearts who often were facing down really terrible odds. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot about resilience from them that I also wanted to like do justice to when I was writing about it. But I honestly, if we'd met like 2 years ago, I would have said like there is nothing of me in the prosperity gospel. Okay. Not one little bit.
As Susan says on Twitter, living with stage 4 ovarian cancer, that thing that just happened with Jason on the phone, you get to hear from everyone about how much they love you.
Yeah.
Other people don't ever know.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to put it in like a morbid way, like you get your living funeral, but like, I think it's good for everyone to know like what they mean to other people. That's a gift.
Call here from Brian in Eden Prairie. Hi, Brian. Thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Oh, absolutely. Good morning.
Good morning.
I really just wanted to call in to say thank you. I'm a Moravian pastor in the Twin Cities area, and I was on my way to the hospital. Still am, to visit a friend and colleague.
Yeah.
And my wife was diagnosed a year ago tomorrow with stage 3B lung cancer. Oh. Yeah. And she's doing well. She's on immunotherapy. She's done the chemo and radiation thing. But, you know, we've really just looked for these kind of footholds. And we've gotten involved with the Gildas Club of the Twin Cities and doing improv classes together. We have two teenage children, actually a 20-year-old who's in college. But listening to the program this morning, I just started bawling, and I literally pulled over, ran into the bookstore, bought the book.
Mission accomplished, Brian. Excellent.
And I didn't necessarily feel I had anything really to contribute to the conversation, but just really want to thank you and just what you're doing and the vulnerability and the grace you're showing. I just imagine there's people that are having this very similar reaction about just that, you know, somebody gets it. Somebody's gone a little further ahead on the path than I have and can leave these little markers for me and my wife. So just very grateful.
Oh, thanks. Well, what a like... I mean, Brian said he's a Moravian. Moravians
yes,
are the best with this stuff. So they're like this, like, I'm going to say weird because I'm Mennonite and that's pretty weird too. but they're this like small group founded by a man named Count von Zinzendorf, which is my favorite. But like, here's the best part about Moravians. For Easter, they get ready by washing all the tombstones. And then when the sun rises, they will play these beautiful songs to the dawn. And what I love about that is it says to both the dead and the living, like, there is something so beautiful we find, like, here in the darkness. And so, like, I love the Moravians. They are my absolute favorite.
Lisa says on Twitter, I'm part of the Young Clergy Women International, and Kate's book has swept through our group like wildfire. It's helping people heal. It's helping people minister to people in hard places. It's changing lives. And then she says, thank you, Kate. That was something I was curious about, Kate, whether, as with Brian, you're hearing from other pastors and people in faith communities who are understanding better about how to minister to people who are going through something like this.
Well, I mean, I live in pastor world because I'm at the Divinity School, which was my favorite part about, I think I can say the only good part about being in the hospital was that everybody had clergy privileges. So like everyone had a clerical collar, hundreds of people. And honestly, I would say I'm learning the most from them because they live in hospital world too. They are chaplains. They are people who show up to the sick and are there at funerals. Like, pastors are my people in a moment like this. And I really think I'm learning more from them. But I'm really grateful to hear that.
So pastors know how to do this a little better than the doctors do.
Oh man, pastors are the front lines of terrible. And like for that, we give them a hand clap for sure.
You know, I think it might be Bishop Spong who talked for a long time about how he would show up, you know, in someone's household where they were grieving, and he would say things like, things happen for a reason, you know, those kinds of things. And it wasn't until he had his own very personal tragedy, I think with the death of a child, that he understood how specious and empty that was to say that. Do people still say it to you? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people are like on it. They want me to know. It's not just like that there is meaning in tragedy, but they want to say, if they're saying everything happens for a reason, they're wanting to say that I can know the answer usually within the course of my life, or that they can for sure know the answer. And I think there's a tremendous desire to like see the matrix. And I'm more than willing to say that God is doing something beautiful in the midst of the terrible, or that God has like incredible reasons that God knows. But like, I will not say that the thing that is taking my life apart is to teach me a lesson, or that anyone else can know that lesson and show up and tell me about it. No, thanks.
Have you gotten to the point where you can say that back to people?
I don't know. It mostly just like pushes me into a deep resentment spiral where I'm like, cool, 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 in my car. Yeah, that's hard.
A call here from Amy in Minneapolis. Hi, Amy.
Thank you for waiting.
Hi.
You betcha. Say, I am resonating with every single syllable of this conversation.
Wow.
Thank you so much for having it. I, in 2012, my husband, he was 40 at the time, he was having a little pain in his bottom. We thought it was hemorrhoids. One colonoscopy later, it was stage 4 cancer off the bat. And 5.5 months later, he was gone. And in between his diagnosis and his death, my mom died 20 days before
sweet.
He did.
Amy. Oh.
Yeah. And I, and so nothing, what I've learned from that, I mean, it is, and life literally broke in half for me, the before and after, almost like buying a ticket for Paris and getting dropped off in Timbuktu forever.
Yeah.
And, so no answer satisfies why did it happen? And that idea of there's a reason, that's, we all know that, that that's for, when people say that who haven't been through tremendous suffering, they're doing that for themselves. And they're trying to make an understanding of something that is impossible to understand. But I will say this, I live in the duality, and I'm okay with that. I am okay with no answer satisfies, and that's okay. Some days it's less okay than others, but that is my life. And I don't want anybody minimizing or taking away what was before, now that I'm living in the now. And it's just part of life and maturing, and I'm grateful, but I'm not happy, but I'm at peace with it. Does that make sense?
So, Amy, does that mean that you are able, I mean, this is something that Kate and I were talking about earlier with, I want to be able to be honest to say my life before was better, and I want people to let me be able to say that. And are you able to?
At times, because I feel sometimes I miss what I have so much, and I don't want to miss the blessings, and I don't want to be ungrateful for what I have. But I also don't want to. It's so complicated. I can't wait to pick up the book, because it really is hard to help people understand. Going back to the Timbuktu thing, it's like, I remember I told people, it's like sitting on the tarmac in Timbuktu and saying, well, I'm not supposed to be here. That's the shock. That's the denial. And I want to get back to my trip to Paris, but I can't go there. I have to make the best of Timbuktu. And that's beautiful, but damn it, I wasn't supposed to be here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And like, man, when you said gratitude, like, yes, I am grateful, but like, my gratitude shouldn't be used to make other people feel better that my life is worse right now. You know, like, it still sucks. It still sucks. And I just wish, like, I think that's right. There's this huge emotional burden placed on especially women to be like, no, I'm so happy. Thank you. No, this is definitely better. I'm like, no, like, there's stuff that, like, yeah, there's stuff I lost along the way.
And I'm going to talk about it. Right?
Yeah. And I
mean, that's the
something.
Thing, right?
Yes. And I will not keep it to myself.
I want to be able to talk about it. You know,
that's
so,
right.
I think Amy nailed this when she said, you know, some of this is about people like me who have not dealt with a serious, unjust tragedy like this, to just say, well, I'm protected from that in some ways, right? It's the lie we tell ourselves about.
Yeah.
Because I didn't do this and I did it. They are all lies. I get that. But it's this fake sense of protection
in
the face of calamity, right?
It is. Yeah. And like, I have to admit, like, that was the part that kind of hurt my feelings, like, immediately, was people's attempts to explain me in a way to create distance between me and them.
Right.
And it was like, I mean, I had a situation in which I found myself saying to someone who was expressing their discomfort with my illness, like, but you do know I'm not the only person in your life who's ever going to die, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm like bargaining with them, like, you know that your state of fine is temporary, right? And like, I don't want to be the one that like goes around bringing the tyranny of sadness, like, and you're going to die, and you're going to die, and you're going to die. But like, but I just, at the same time, it does make you feel incredibly lonely when other people can't realize, like, look, no one is special. Bad things happen to everybody in differing degrees, but like, being fine's lovely and temporary.
Andy tweeted, and I've gotten a lot of tweets like this, Kate, I want you to know it. This is the most authentic and therefore awesome radio program I can ever remember.
Cool.
Thank you both. Sally, what a gift today's show is. Pulled by the side of the road to fully appreciate the last 13 minutes. We'll send a link of the broadcast to my family and friends. Thank you, Kate. Yeah. And to Dana in St. Paul. And Dana, thank you so much for waiting. I'm sorry it took so long to get to you. I might have missed Dana. Shoot. I'm sorry about that. Do you feel, I mean, you're in a teaching role every day, Kate, as an assistant professor at Duke Divinity School. You're doing I think you're doing a whole different level of teaching with the memoir. What's come back to you about that?
Well, first of all, I think honestly this show is like the first time I'm sort of feeling like the, oh, it's in the world. It is doing things.
Really?
So thank you. Yeah, thank you for that. It's because like the bubble, the cancer bubble, like my life got really small. Like it got as small as I needed it to spend time with my family and to, you know, keep having a job and to go to the hospital. And so being public about this book is the first time I'm like in the world again as like a slightly different person. So I'm grateful to like see parts of myself reflected back and be able to just take a minute and say like, oh, I'm in there too.
I think Dana called back. Hey, Dana, hi.
Hi, this is Dana.
I'm sorry about that. Dana, I made you wait so long, but go ahead.
Yes, I'm driving to Regent's Hospital right now for my cancer infusion. I pulled over. I'm not driving. And I just wanted to say that when my daughter was in kindergarten, I fainted. And I'd never been sick, never had chicken pox, never had my tonsils out. So my husband took me to Regent's Hospital, and I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And we were just shocked. I was lying in a bed at Regents for 5 weeks while they tried to figure out what was going on. And I remember I didn't have a white light experience. I remember I was lying in my bed one day watching reruns of Frasier, and I thought, this is how people get depressed. But I am not going down that road. And I didn't have a white light experience, but I decided to clean up my life. It wasn't better before. It's better now. 10.5 years later, it's better now. I am around people who feed me. I have kept my friends who feed me. I read books who feed me, many of them recommended by Carrie.
Please, Dana. Thank you.
And I go to movies that feed me. I volunteer. I give back. And my life is better now. And it was not a white-like experience. It was just a practical decision.
Yeah. Yeah. Bravo. I mean, like, that's so true that the little behavioral things like the deciding not to just lie down the whole time. I mean, that's partly why I wrote the book is I needed to try to let cancer take up as little room as possible and finding, I don't know. I just decided that like the best version of life is one where there's competing goods. Like there's too many good things that are like jostling against each other. And I decided I love teaching. I love writing. I love the snuggle time. And like that is going to take up as much space as possible so that I'm barely thinking about my appointment at the hospital before I have it. And like that worked for me.
Kate, we are a community of readers. What have you been reading that's been giving you sustenance and optimism?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned When Breath Becomes Air because that is just a gorgeous man and a beautiful family. And I'm sort of, and the other is the Bright Hour by Nina Riggs.
Okay.
Other people who've walked a similar path.
This has been such a pleasure. I really anticipated it. I was really eager to talk to you, Kate. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kate Bowler's memoir is called Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.